A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of the Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something pretty significant, I think, a really important mission, actually, diving into Naomi Klein's landmark 2007 book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And this book, well, it doesn't just recount history. It fundamentally tries to reframe how you look at basically every major global crisis over the last 50 years or so.
That's exactly it. We're not just, you know, summarizing a book here. We're trying to help you acquire a new lens, really.
A new lens,
yeah.
Klein's central argument, her thesis, it's a pretty radical challenge to the standard story, the one about how free market capitalism spread around the world.
Right, the idea that it was all peaceful and democratic choice.
Exactly. She argues, no, that wasn't it. It was systematically imposed by, well, exploiting massive collective shocks.
Shocks?
Like military coups or devastating natural disasters or huge economic collapses, using those moments to push through policies that were actually deeply unpopular, things people wouldn't normally accept.
Okay, so our goal for you, the listener, is to gain this critical perspective so that maybe when the next major global event happens, you can start to recognize the patterns of what she calls disaster capitalism.
Yeah, and start asking those really crucial questions. Okay, who's benefiting here? Who's being pushed aside in this emergency?
Right. But before we dive into the shocks themselves, maybe we should introduce the person behind this idea. Who is Naomi Klein?
Good idea. Well, she's a Canadian author, journalist, and activist, and she's really known for her incredibly detailed on-the-ground research.
She got a lot of attention for No Logo back in 2000, didn't she?
That's right. Yeah, No Logo was huge, a big critique of corporate branding and globalization. The Shock Doctrine came later, building on some of that work.
So what makes her take on economic history so different? Because she's not like a traditional academic economist, is she?
No, not at all. And that's key. Her authority really comes from years of firsthand field research. She went to these crisis zones, Iraq after the invasion, Argentina during its economic meltdown, New Orleans after Katrina hit.
Wow. So she's seeing it unfold directly.
Exactly. And she talks to the people affected. She brings together historical facts, the economic theory, especially from the Chicago School, and these grassroots perspectives that lets her sort of connect the dots, you know?
Yeah, uncover power dynamics that maybe a purely economic analysis might miss.
That's the idea, looking at who actually holds the power in these chaotic situations.
That kind of global, ground-level investigation definitely gives her a unique perspective. Okay, so let's get into the central metaphor of the book. It's quite disturbing, actually. She links modern economic shock therapy to old CIA psychiatric experiments.
Yeah, it's a really dark analogy, but she argues it's fundamental to understanding the doctrine. She talks about Dr. Ewan Cameron back in the 1950s.
Right, the MKUltra stuff.
Part of that context, yes. He used things like massive electroshocks, sensory deprivation, drug-induced comas, all trying to basically erase a patient's memory and personality to create a blank slate for therapy, supposedly.
Okay, that's horrifying.
It is. And Klein argues that this psychological model is essentially the blueprint for economic shock therapy.
So the parallel strategy is use a disaster, a crisis, to traumatize an entire society.
Right.
Create this collective blank slate where all the existing ways of doing things, public health care, schools, worker protections, can just be wiped away.
Wiped away and then quickly replaced by a really radical free market system, mass privatization, deregulation, severe cuts to public spending austerity.
The idea being that a population reeling from trauma is too disoriented to resist these huge changes.
That's the core of it. And the book's scope is huge. She traces this pattern across six decades, multiple continents.
Chile, Russia, Iraq.
Exactly. And her fundamental argument, really her ambition, is to show that it wasn't democratic consent that spread these policies. It was coercion. It was the exploitation of trauma.
That's a really powerful claim, that the strategy needs trauma, maybe even political violence, to work. How does she square that with the idea that free markets lead to freedom?
Well, she argues it's the other way around. The shock comes first because, she says, when people actually have a choice, they tend to reject these really harsh policies.
So the shock makes the unpopular possible.
Precisely. And she points to Milton Friedman, the economist, as the sort of ideological architect here. He famously said something like, only a crisis real or perceived produces real change.
Okay.
And Friedman's point was, when that crisis hits, what happens next depends on the ideas that are just lying around. So you need to have your radical ideas ready to go.
Waiting for the window of opportunity.
Exactly. Proactive, not reactive.
And the first big test case she identifies, the origin story almost, was Pinochet's Chile after the 1973 coup.
Yes, that's where it really gets applied systematically for the first time on a national scale. The military, too, was the shock.
And Friedman's followers, the Chicago Boys, yeah, are there.
They were ready. These were Chilean economists trained in Friedman's neoclassical economics at the University of Chicago. They came in and implemented radical privatization, deep cuts to social spending.
But Klein argues the violence wasn't just incidental to the coup.
Right. No, she argues it was essential for the economic plan. The systematic torture, the repression that was necessary to crush the democratic opposition, the unions, anyone who would fight against these incredibly painful economic changes being forced through.
Wow. So the theory from Chicago meets state terror in Santiago. That's quite a trajectory. But okay, Chile needed a military dictatorship. How did this playbook adapt for countries that were already democracies?
Good question. She looks next at Margaret Thatcher's Britain in the early 80s, specifically 1982.
The Falklands War.
Exactly. The shock wasn't a coup, it was the war. The crisis, the patriotic fervor that came with it. Thatcher used that political cover, that sort of emergency atmosphere,
to push through things she couldn't otherwise.
Right. Deeply unpopular reforms. The most famous example, of course, is breaking the miners' union, a hugely powerful force in British politics at the time. The crisis provided the distraction, the justification.
So, using a national emergency for domestic political and economic goals.
Yeah.
Okay. Then fast forward to the early 90s, post-Soviet Russia. That seems like a massive shock.
Oh, absolutely. The collapse of communism was maybe the biggest shock of the late 20th century. And Western economists, many advised by people like Jeffrey Sachs, rushed in pushing for rapid, drastic economic change. It was literally called shock therapy.
Right. I remember that term. Rapid privatization, freeing prices overnight.
Yes, the idea was speed over everything. But Klein documents how this approach didn't really lead to stable democracy and prosperity for most. Instead, you got the rise of the oligarchs.
Who snapped up all the state assets for pennies on the dollar.
Pretty much. Mass poverty for millions, a collapse in industrial capacity, even a shocking drop in life expectancy. She argues it was a devastating example of the human cost of applying this blueprint too fast, too brutally.
And then there's Iraq, which she presents as maybe the purest, most extreme example, where the shock itself was manufactured.
Absolutely. Shock and awe, the military invasion was the shock. It was the explicit precondition.
And then Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator, comes in.
Comes in with a ready-made list, implemented by decree, no Iraqi input, mass privatization of state companies, a flat tax, just 15%, a dream for corporations opening the country completely to foreign investment and control.
It was meant to be a sort of free market utopia built from scratch.
That was the vision, yes. A model corporate state built on the rubble. But as Klein shows, the result was catastrophe. Chaos, insurgency, and crucially, immense profits for a select group of Western corporations. Halliburton, Blackwater, the whole disaster capitalism complex, as she calls it.
That term, disaster capitalism complex. We'll come back to that. But first, she even brings it home, applying the idea to natural disasters within the U.S., right? Post-Katrina New Orleans.
Yes, and this is maybe one of the most chilling examples for many readers. The shock of the hurricane, the flooding, the displacement.
Was used as an opportunity.
Was exploited, she argues, to essentially dismantle the New Orleans public school system. It was largely destroyed, yes, but instead of rebuilding it, it was almost entirely replaced by privately run charter schools.
And public housing too, right?
Yeah, many public housing projects were demolished, not rebuilt, effectively displacing long-term, mostly Black residents. It led to what she describes as these fortified, privatized green zones for elites and contractors, while the most vulnerable were left behind in the devastated red zones.
A stark illustration of the model operating right inside the U.S.
Absolutely. It shows how disaster capitalism isn't just something that happens over there.
Okay, so if we look across all these examples, Chile, the U.K., Russia, Iraq, New Orleans, what are the main takeaways, the core themes Klein wants us to grasp?
I think there are three big ones. The first is that psychological insight, the deliberate exploitation of crisis and collective trauma.
Right. This is the really crucial part to internalize, isn't it? That proponents of these policies aren't just reacting to crises. They actively look for them. or even create them.
Because, as she argues, populations that are scared, disoriented, grieving, they're just less able to organize and resist fundamental changes to their society.
So for us, when we see policies being rushed through during an emergency, whether it's a pandemic, a war, a climate event, we need to pause and ask, is this policy truly proportional to the crisis? Or is it using the crisis as cover?
Exactly. That's the lens. The second big theme is what this does to the public sphere. The goal, consistently, is the systematic dismantling of public services.
Turning things like schools, healthcare, security, even disaster response itself into commodities. Things to be bought and sold for profit.
Precisely. And this has a huge effect. It shrinks the space for democratic control and accountability. It subtly shifts our identity from citizen with rights and collective responsibilities towards just being a consumer in the marketplace.
Okay, and the third theme, you mentioned it touches on democracy itself.
Yeah, this is maybe the most challenging one. Klein argues forcefully that these really pure, radical free market policies are, in practice, incompatible with genuine democratic choice.
Because people consistently reject them when they have a free vote.
That's her evidence. Across different cultures and contexts, these policies, deep austerity, mass privatization, deregulation, are generally unpopular. So to get them implemented, you either need authoritarian force, like in Chile,
or you need the disorientation of a major shock to bypass democratic opposition.
Right. So it fundamentally challenges that very common assumption that free markets and political freedom always go hand in hand. She says the historical record often shows the opposite.
The book is also full of really memorable phrases and concepts, isn't it? Things that stick with you.
Definitely. That Milton Friedman quote is central. Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around.
It reveals that proactive waiting game, doesn't it?
Mm.
Have the unpopular plan ready for when disaster strikes.
Yeah, it's not accidental. It's strategic waiting.
And then there's that core psychological metaphor we talked about earlier.
Right, the idea that the shock doctrine tries to do to a whole society what torture tries to do to an individual. Break resistance through disorientation and fear.
It really highlights the kind of, well, violent psychological and sometimes physical involved in forcing these rapid economic shifts.
Yes. And the third key concept is that disaster capitalism complex.
The industries that profit from disaster.
Exactly. Entire sectors, private security, reconstruction firms, risk modeling, even certain NGOs whose business models depend on instability, on climate change, on security threats.
So crisis isn't just a temporary problem to be solved.
It becomes a permanent, profitable market, a self-sustaining feature of the economy, not a bug.
Okay, so bringing this all back to the listener, how can we use this understanding in our own lives? When the next crisis hits, what's the practical application?
Well, first and foremost, it's about critical media literacy, just being vigilant when disaster strikes.
Asking those hard questions.
Yeah. Are the solutions being proposed really just about recovery? Or are they smuggling in a pre-existing agenda? Do emergency powers have clear sunset clauses? Or are they open-ended?
And follow the money. Who benefits immediately?
Always follow the money. That cuts through a lot of the rhetoric, especially when people are scared and looking for quick answers.
And you mentioned the focus on public services earlier. That seems like a key area for local action.
Absolutely. Because, as the New Orleans example showed, public schools, hospitals, public transit, these are often the first targets for privatization or deep cuts when there's an emergency budget crisis or a disaster.
So getting involved locally, defending those services, becomes really important.
It does. It's about recognizing the value of these collective goods, things we own and control together, versus just handing everything over to private profit motives. Civic engagement really matters here.
And ultimately, Klein does offer an alternative, doesn't she? An antidote.
She does. It's about building resilience from the bottom up. A democratic response to crisis. She calls it people's reconstruction.
Which means?
Supporting things like local mutual aid networks, people helping each other directly, strengthening community-owned projects, credit unions, local businesses that are rooted in the community. Basically, anything that reduces our dependence on these large, remote corporate systems that disaster capitalism tends to favor.
Building local strength and connection as a buffer against exploitation during shocks.
Exactly. Community resilience is the counterforce.
Okay. As we wrap up, any final thoughts? What really struck you or surprised you going back through this book?
For me, honestly, it's the sheer consistency she documents, the playbook, as you called it, seeing the same steps, the same goals applied in such different places, dictatorships, democracies, post-war zones, after natural disasters.
It suggests it's not just random chance.
Right. The systematic nature of it really drives home her argument that this is or was a conscious global strategy, not just a series of disconnected bad decisions or accidents. That consistency is quite compelling and, frankly, disturbing.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, the biggest takeaway is that reminder that crises aren't just moments of danger. They're also moments of possibility. They open things up.
For good or for ill.
Exactly. Yeah. And by understanding the shock doctrine playbook, by knowing what tactics might be deployed, we're better equipped to resist the negative side. We can organize, we can demand that recovery efforts actually strengthen our communities and our democratic institutions rather than dismantling them.
Recognizing the pattern is the first step to breaking it.
Well said. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.